Golf Weekly
from Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Off the Ball Open in Abu Dhabi this November. Book your place now at offtheball.com/open.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner for caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Andrew, welcome along. Golf Weekly friends. We have much to discuss. Peter Lawrie of Spawell fame has called in. Hello.
Hello, Joe.
How is all at Spawell?
All good, thank you.
Have you reset the top tracer for Portrush yet?
Oh, that'll be happening soon.
Pebble Beach is gone.
Pebble Beach is gone. Actually, they're bringing in St Andrews onto it.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So a lot of people would like to play St Andrews, who's never been there.
Mm.
But yeah, loads of people came up and played the US Open course, Pebble Beach. Yeah. So it was a good fun.
Good. Fionn Davenport is here. He has played St Andrews. Hi, Fionn.
I have indeed. Hey, lads.
Hello, Fionn.
How are we doing?
Hey, Pete. Very well, thank you.
US Open to review, that is what we have to do. Nathan away this afternoon, but we're in good health here with three. So some tweets in no particular order. Wish I could golf each day. Matt Wallace behaves like an arsehole. I know this probably seems like the wrong one to start off on, given what Gary Woodland has done. We'll come to Gary. Matt Wallace behaves like an arsehole. See, I've missed all this. I haven't seen this. He carries on like a child all year because, quote, he wants to win so much. Even Beamer commented on it in round two. But playing with Brooks in round three, there wasn't a peep out of him because Brooks wouldn't put up with that shit. It shows Wallace knows it's crap behaviour. This has passed me by. I was just saying it to you before we came on air and you were saying a bit of a temper.
It has been there before, yeah, to be honest with you. Look, these guys, they take it out. They're very highly strung.
Mm.
He has another Irishman on the bag, actually, Dave McNeely.
Oh, yeah.
Has been caddying for him for quite some time. And Dave is the type of character who kind of would put up with it. But would see it as a fueling him on, you know what I mean, actually gets him to a better position.
Okay.
Matt Wallace, I think, has to be a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. I think he was hard done by not getting a call up to the Ryder Cup that time.
Yeah.
He was very close to it. He was the man in form.
Mm. Golf is so frustrating, and they are highly strung, and tempers will flare up. We've all been the golfer who just wanted to snap our club, you know? In the pro ranks, whatever bit amateur or me and Fionn play, in the pro ranks, how frowned upon is it for a player to scream and cuss and maybe give the bag a wallop after he hits a bad shot and maybe even before you're, you know, about to hit, you might be 15 yards further up in the fairway. How accepted is a little mini 20-second tantrum?
It's funny, when they're playing with their peers, they seem to get away with it. But when they're playing with the higher echelon guys, they kind of toned it down. There's only one or two that kind of just don't give a crap about anybody. It's a famous story of Richie Ramsey, who was playing in the British Open in Carnoustie, and he was playing with David Toms. And David Toms was at his height of his career. He had just probably won the Masters. Did he win the Masters?
I don't think so.
David Toms? Anyway, he'd won a big tournament.
Yeah. Quite a genteel character.
Yes. And Richie Ramsey came off one of the holes and battered the crap out of his golf bag, out of a tailor-made golf bag. And David Toms came over to him and he said, Richie, are you finished there? And Richie goes, what are you talking about? That's, you know what I mean? Nothing to do with you. David Toms says, it's my fucking golf bag.
Oh. Oh. Ouch.
So, yeah. Yeah, look, these guys can have a freak out at any moment. Mm. But mainly they tend to do it with the same kind of level players.
Yeah.
But put them with a Thomas Bjorn or something like that, it's not tolerated.
Behave themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David Toms won the 2001 PGA.
Okay.
That was it. Yeah. Good man. Good man. Well remembered. Fionnán Doonan sent us a nice pic. He enjoyed a lovely round with his uncle, his father-in-law and his brother at Slieve Russell Golf Club. Fantastic course set up. Nice picture. And looks very good. Hashtag friend of the pod. Alan McGrain. Ah, yes. I knew this would come up. So there was a video on Twitter of Jordan Spieth and Michael Greller and their moment. Alan says, lads, can you discuss in next week's pod? Mm. Justin Speed too harsh on the caddy, or should he go back to school teaching? That's Greller he's talking about. I assume Spieth didn't know the mic could pick him up saying it, so maybe it's not that out of character for him of late. I guess it's hard for us to know if he knew he was being caught on mic or on camera. Fox Sports, I heard one of their, Joe Buck, being interviewed a while back, and he was saying Fox Sports in the States have not revolutionised, but certainly been the pioneers of audio. So they were the first, for instance, in NFL to mic up the scrums and the huddles. So audio is a big thing with Fox. So even with their golf coverage, they've almost prided themselves upon catching lots of the action with their audio. So Spieth was caught very audibly saying, you know, two perfect shots, Michael. You put me in the water for one. And by the way, that shouldn't have happened. Put me in the water for one, over the green for two. And says it quite loudly, I think. It's hard to know how close the camera is with the quality of zoom. These days it might have been 50, 60, 70 yards away, the camera. And Greller Fionn has not many options really because of the power dynamic in a caddy-player relationship, but to put his head down and follow his player to the next shot.
Okay, so I saw Alan's tweet as well, and I have a few thoughts on it that I'm assuming Peter, having been in the actual line of fire, might agree or disagree. So this is what I think. Spieth is an emotive character, always has been. Greller would know that anyway. So it's not as if Spieth is behaving out of character. Oftentimes with caddies, the relationship they have with their player is so idiosyncratic. And I always assumed that the relationship that Greller had with Spieth was that he understood that Spieth voiced how he felt, that Greller was a receptacle for how he felt, and that was okay, and they had a good dynamic, that Greller was comfortable enough in his own skin to be able to absorb anything that Spieth said to him, even, and you know, he wasn't particularly nasty, but he certainly let him know that he felt that Greller was to blame for two major mistakes, and that Greller kind of went, right, okay, let's move on. Then gave me pause, right? So a couple of holes later, in the same round, Spieth hit a bad shot. He hit one where he said to Greller, and you can hear it audibly, where he's going, there's no way I'm going over. I'm not going long here. And Greller goes, no. And sure enough, Spieth hits a wedge long into the rough left at the back of the thing. Spieth not a peep out of him. And I am convinced, because Spieth shut the face of the club and kind of pull hooked it slightly, so inevitably it's going to go long. So Spieth recognized that's my mistake, not Greller's. He gave me the yardage. If I'd hit a clean shot, that would have been exactly where we wanted it to be. And so it led me to think then, maybe Greller did give him bad information, you know? And so, I mean, I don't know. This is completely open and short of Jordan Spieth actually coming on and explaining it to us, or Michael Greller coming on to defend himself. I don't know that we'll ever know. But anyway, so that's the way I characterize it. And I guess, Peter, having been in the line of fire, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does, Fionn. Well, first of all, the audio has improved dramatically with Fox Sports, and you can hear the actually click of the ball and the ball going in the hole, which is fantastic for the audience. When you come to somebody like Spieth and you look at the mistakes that were made, the caddy doesn't make a mistake on yardages. Not in this day and age. Everything is done to the letter. So where they're going to make the mistake is either elevation or wind. And I felt Spieth's, the shot that he hit over the green, the four iron that he hit over the green, he hit it left of the flag. I had heard prior to that they were trying to hit in a soft four iron left to right in against the breeze. And that didn't seem to happen. He hit it pretty straight, which you're going to get an extra 10, 15 yards on. So I think the mistake was, and I don't think I've ever blamed a caddy for a yardage, and they can come on and say, yes, I did. But I'm nearly sure that I've never really, it's my fault. Pretty much, because I'm the idiot who hit it. You know what I mean? So I would have to say that I think Spieth is clutching at straws right at this moment in time. And you know, I'm not a great believer in Jordan Spieth, as we all say. But you can see it in everybody's career, okay? They reach to the top, and then they start going down, then they start coming back up again. They get very frustrated when they can't get back to where they were. And they have to learn how, you know, flaws in the different combinations of caddy-player relationships. Mm. And they don't really want to blame themselves, so they want to blame something else that, you know, I'm perfect, or I'm on my way back up, and you're kind of holding me back.
Well, that struck me that possibly, with regard to his confidence and sense of well-being about his game, it could have been a defence mechanism to put it on the caddy. I didn't hit a bad shot. That is on you, Michael. That's on you twice. Like, I don't know, particularly the tee shot, how they ended up in the water, because everybody was laying up so far short of that water because there is a downslope towards the cliff.
Yeah.
I'd love to get to the bottom of that mistake. The one over the green, I'd say it is more what you're saying, Spieth maybe closed the face a touch and they were going to hit in a soft little fade and it didn't happen. I'd say he was already pent up from the first mistake and so was more inclined to blame him than later on, as Fionn talked about that other example. But I just don't understand what happened with the first shot. I don't know how they ended up in that position where he had to take a drop. I'd love to know what happened. Yeah. There were pictures on Sky the next day of them in the driving range having a pretty animated conversation before going out to warm up, like they were caught, you know, at the corner of the...
Yeah, and I'm amazed by that. Like, Jordan Spieth knows there's cameras everywhere and there's microphones everywhere. And he, I don't know whether he's done that to, you know, put his caddy in his spot and go, you know, I'm the boss and you're just a bag man and this is the way it's happening and, you know, let the whole world see me giving out to you.
Yeah.
Like, take those things behind closed doors and sort out your issues.
That made me slightly worried that they were still doing it the next day. Now, look, who knows? Maybe that conversation the next day is about who's paying for dinner that night. I mean, we don't know.
No, it definitely... there was the arms and there was the, you know... And
there was a, this is my point of view, and this is my point of view, and clashing heads. And they always fascinate me because Greller is such like an alpha male. You know, he just is. In most walks of life, if you were to compare those two, Greller would be the dude. And yet he's in this weird position where he's the caddy and Spieth is, I guess, the alpha in the relationship. And that's another kind of interesting layer. I mean, what would be fascinating for you to know, is this like a serious, unusual situation with these two? Or is this not par for the course, excuse the pun, but if this is semi-regular?
Maybe I'm being entirely naive or very optimistic about the future of Jordan and Michael Greller, but like... I just assume this is indeed par for the course. And because one of the things that you notice is Spieth never talks about I. He always talks about we.
Yeah.
That's his thing. He's not the only one. It's become very much the norm for we put it here, we hit this shot. And so short of Spieth, as Peter, you know, very kind of correctly probably says, is like Spieth is probably very frustrated. And something you said, Joe, I totally agree with. I think that maybe part of the dynamic between the caddy and the player is for the caddy to know that you have to be the punching bag for some of these frustrations. Because in order for the player to play that fluid, free golf that they're meant to play, they can't be carrying negativity. So, you know, maybe that's... And dynamics between, I'm assuming, to be close partnerships can be very nuanced and very... difficult to say, but what I'm all of my answer refuses to acknowledge the possibility that the relationship is breaking down.
I know, I would hate that because they're a good partnership.
Exactly.
Greller's one of the more high profile caddies, like partially because of his story and partially because of Spieth's success, and he's just quite a memorable face. Have you heard word either way? If Greller and Spieth parted, would he be an in demand caddy, do we think, or would he have to go back to teaching?
I think he'd take some time out. For sure. And I definitely think there's going to be a split there, even for a short-term period.
Do you?
Yeah. Where it's... I definitely think there'll be Jordan... Either Greller takes a week off or there's a change there.
I guess because if you're Spieth, you've got to try different things now. You're into that horrible space where a change is as good as a rest.
Yeah.
That's bad news for Greller. But do you think Greller would be in demand if that split became permanent? Or would people look at him in a Harry Diamond way and say, well, you were good for him as opposed to you're an excellent caddy? I presume Greller would have really learned the ropes in the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And he's, you know, they seem to get on well with a lot of the players out there. So,
yeah.
I definitely think he'd be snapped up by somebody.
What percentage of guys get a caddy just basically on personality and might even in their private moments admit, he's not a brilliant caddy, you know, I do a lot of the yardages myself, I can kind of figure out most of the things, I just like having him around, or do you need someone with a good skill set?
Paul McGinley was number one for that with Edinburgh Jimmy. You know, Edinburgh Jimmy wasn't able to keep up, he wasn't able to, but it was just the actual person, the character, the, you know, the interesting stories and whatever else that would go on. So, look, some players are just a little bit different. They can do it themselves, but they like a caddy to take them away from it, and then they can come back into it themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be a pity. They just seem like a very likeable partnership. Greller on the bag for someone else. I just wouldn't like to see that.
No.
Wouldn't like it at all. Donald O'Hagan says, Woodland, very worthy winner, lads. The chip across the 17th green defines what his performance was about all day. Poise and confidence in his ability. Hashtag friend of the pod. Bradley says, Koepka's last nine majors. Second, first, tied 39th, first, tied 13th, tied 6th, first, tied 11th. Hard to argue he won't win double-digit majors. Yeah, we'll come on to Koepka and Woodland in a second. Andrew says, congrats to at Gary Woodland. Quality player. Always had the game to win a major. Showed it over the weekend that the short game is what separates everyone in the end. Interestingly, by the way, there was a Golf Weekly poll. Who did we want to win? Woodland, Rose, Koepka or Westhuizen? This was obviously a few rounds in. And Koepka got 53% of the vote. He crushed everyone. Woodland 16, Rose 14, Westhuizen 17. I know, Fionn, if like Rory and Tiger and maybe Spieth were on that shortlist, then Koepka wouldn't have featured. But with Woodland, Rose and Westhuizen, he got 53%. And I have to say, on Sunday and Saturday and kind of all week, really, I was cheering him on in a big way. I like, yeah. Nothing kind of breeds like ability, like success. I'm right on board the Koepka train now.
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, in our little WhatsApp group, I said it last week. I wasn't that big a fan of Koepka. There's something about him that kind of irritates me. But I have to say, I've come around, as you say, is nothing like success breeds kind of respect and admiration, in that, like, despite falling short this week, he is unquestionably one of the great golfers of the modern age. Like, in a sense, one of the things, and I realized that, like, you know, 3 years ago we were saying that Jordan Spieth was untouchable, that, like, you know, his mental game was so strong and et cetera, et cetera. But so maybe this is Koepka's time, but my God, is he making the most of it? Like, and, you know, his game is really, really good. His short game is really good. He's a good putter. But more than anything, it's just his focus and concentration. And even though he fell short, he did nothing but boost his greatness last week. It absolutely boosted the sense of, and maybe last week it just kind of irritated me, his comment about, like, that the Fox analyst guy or the guy puts the packages together, should be fired. Maybe that's what it was, clouded my sense of perspective. But, like, I thought his post-round interviews were very, very good. I think he's clearly an intelligent man who understands his own game very, very well. And I was cheering for him on Sunday as well. Sorry, Gary Woodland. Sorry, Justin Rose. But the story, the Koepka story. Had he been able to win and hold it for three times in a row, it's amazing.
Gary Harkin on the Koepka Fox promo thing tweeted in to say, "See info from ESPN article," and he sent a link. Fox Sports made four promos. Koepka was heavily featured in three of them. For one of them, it was entirely about Brooks Koepka. It featured no other golfers, but he happened to see the one that didn't feature him, and it was a slight he could not forgive.
Yeah, so, and I think I made that point last week, is I don't really believe that he didn't see the other three, but it's just that, like, for him to get so antsy about that one just seemed silly. And anyway, that's old news. I am now 100% Brooks Koepka.
Is Brooks the new Jack Nicklaus?
Ooh, I was thinking that.
As in admired, but maybe not loved?
No, when he came out onto the scene, he wasn't very well liked because everybody loved Arnold Palmer. And it was all about Arnold Palmer and nothing about Jack. And Jack had the same problems that Brooks is going through now.
Yeah.
But he was a similar kind of, a meaty kind of fella. you know, played the game a little bit different. And I think
Jack's body fat percentage was higher than Kepka.
Just a little bit.
Both meaty, but different kinds of meat, I think.
One's a bit softer than the other.
Did you notice that there was a couple of things, like even for Kepka, who generally maintains a very kind of hyper-concentrated demeanor on the golf course, shows very little emotion, but even small little things like giving the golf ball to the little girl when he's walking from the green to the tee, he's like, he's not averse to the odd hand slap. So he's like, I mean, as much as you expect a golfer in contention to interact with the crowd or anything other than just his immediate bubble, I thought Kepka did well insofar as to kind of just to show a little bit.
Well, I think he was obviously enjoying it more than Bethpage. Yeah. You know, we spoke to Ricky Elliott and that seemed like no fun. Last few tweets then. LeBret says, Woodland seems like a great guy. Yeah, Rich Beam definitely made a point of saying he's one of the good guys. Like, sometimes when they don't say anything, you wonder what's the true story, but he made a point of saying Woodland's one of the good guys. Cormac Sheehy wanted Rose and Woodland put in the clock. They were a hole behind through the eighth. It's on late enough without that crap. Alan McGrain wanted your thoughts on Spieth and Greller. We've done that. Darren McGuinness on June 15 said, lads, the nightmare is coming through. Hashtag Kuchar charge. Honestly, there was a moment I said, Matt Kuchar. Don't you goddamn dare, Kuchar. He was thinking about it. Gar Evans, greetings from Rossapenna. There was a beautiful shot here of a really nice grey Donegal sky, but like a kind of
nice grey,
violent one. You know, it was an interesting one. Great company listening to you guys on the road up. Hashtag golf pints, golf pints, golf pints. And Niall Glynn, what's the story with Kepka's hat deal with Nike? My auntie May has the same hat. He's a good-looking fella, but this is wrong in so many levels. This was a picture of Kepka in the really multicolored Nike hat. Yeah. Nike are going for it with the hats,
yeah,
aren't they?
A lot of the Nike players are wearing those horrible hats, but look.
I start off each, same at Bethpage. On the Thursday, I look at them and think, ugh. By Sunday, I'm wondering, could I pull that off? Grows on you.
No.
Grows on you.
No, you couldn't.
And then finally, John Bailey enjoyed the piece with Padraig Harrington. Absolute class, made the M1 traffic disappear this morning. Good. Glad to hear it, John. That is on the Golf Weekly feed if you want it. Now, let's reflect on the US Open. Gary Woodland. 7 previous times he was the 54-hole leader and 7 previous times he didn't get it done. Most recently, I think Xander Schauffele shot like a 61 or 2, so it wasn't like he collapsed. But... Certainly on the Sunday morning, you're thinking that has to feature here. Like, Peter, he was pretty close to not even having a hint of a wobble.
I didn't see really a wobble at all, to be honest with you. But Gary has changed himself around quite considerably when he started working with Pete Cowan. Pete Cowan has changed his game dramatically. And when you hit it that long off the tee and your short game now is as sharp as it is, you know, he's really got that. Pete Cowan and Phil Kenyon have got together kind of as the short game gurus. And they're really doing some really good work with and they've hit it big in America now. They've got their US Open winner now.
Totally, and there was a good piece in The Guardian, I'm sure you've seen it, Fiona, as well, with Pete Cowan, who was sitting in San Francisco Airport watching Gary Woodland win. And funny, he does this, because we had Pete Cowan on Off the Ball the day after Henrik Stenson won the Open in the Jewel of the Suns. And we were like, what was it like to watch Henrik do it? And he said, I was in the car home. I was listening on 5 Live. I don't hang around. It's not my gig. I thought it was amazing.
Once the player goes off the first tee, the coach is gone.
He said, I did the warm-up with Gary. He said he'd never felt more at ease with his swing. That's my job done then. Off to the airport. It's like a racehorse trainer. You do your work in the gallops and then you can't do anything when they're racing. Woodland said that Cowan sent him a text the Sunday morning, which said, every man dies, but not every man lives. And you live for this moment. Which, you know, if I saw that on Instagram, I'd roll my eyes a bit. But I guess when Pete Cowan texts it to Woodland, it's kind of cool. Just to say, so for people who didn't see it, the thing that counts as he's done with Woodland in particular, short game has been mentioned, but was he found that Gary Woodland was ringing him all the time as a crutch. What's going wrong with my swing? You know, he wanted a 2-day clinic one time. So Cowan says, I told him he has to take responsibility for a swing. He has to understand it because if he needs to fix it during a round, he has to do it on his own. And he said, that's the biggest thing with me and Gary is to make him understand his swing. says Gary was into team sports when he was young. Obviously, there's the basketball career. He was always in that environment of being told what to do. He was still stuck in that mindset. He couldn't work it out for himself. And that was, Fionn, what Cowan was saying was the big change, which jumped out for me. Has been very interesting.
Yeah, I read the same piece and had the exact same reaction. I thought of all the analysis of Woodland's win, I thought this was the one that caught my attention the most. The idea that, but that's Cowan's approach generally. I met him a few years ago, and he's kind of a phlegmatic character anyway. You know, like he seems not indifferent, but he seems very kind of like he can take or leave most situations, which probably is a very healthy way to live. As he gets older, like he seems like, for example, here's a great little Pete Cowan thing. Traditionally, when he gave a golf lesson, there wouldn't be a fixed charge. He would ask you at the end of it, go, how much do you think that was worth? And the idea was he would put the responsibility on the individual to determine, well, it's up to you to tell me. Now, Pete Cowan, I'm sure, has done very, very well out of his career as a coach. Lest we forget, he was coached to McDowell when McDowell won in 2010 at Pebble Beach. So this idea of, listen, in the end, it's like we can work on a whole bunch of stuff, but it's up to you to take responsibility to fix your own swing. Mm. And Cowan's absolutely right. Jack Nicklaus could do it. All the old greats could do it. Is they would walk out, and then when they felt like, oh, you know, maybe I'm picking up. Like, I think he gave the example that that Koepka was taking it a little bit inside, so he wanted it a little more upright. But he wants Koepka to be able to fix that on the course, not have to do it away from the course.
Yeah, I was confused with that, because Claude Harmon's definitely his coach, but then Pete Cowan's getting a bit of credit, so I'm not too sure how that works. But it was definitely Claude Harmon who did that with Koepka, who will come on to. On Pete Cowan, Westwood, Clark, McDowell, Henrik Stenson were like his big cohort in Europe, and then they all made it big in America, and now it seems he's flourished, because he said, I was going to retire a while ago, but I can't retire now because this amazing chapter in my life is happening, which is brilliant. Because he said, I was looking at the leaderboard, he was like, I coach him, I worked with him in the past. He said, in the top 15, I've worked at one stage or other with about 12 of them, and 9 of the top 11. Mm. Which is quite phenomenal. They say, that's amazing about you pay him what you think he's worth. They say Matt Kuchar gave him £8.50 and insisted on it. Said, I'm not a penny less than £5, Pete, he said.
There's a strong argument to be made that Pete Cowan is the best golf coach in the world at the moment. And
I always just think it's Butch Harmon. Like, how can anyone know more than Butch?
No, Pete Cowan is the most knowledgeable, by far.
Is he?
The most knowledgeable. Absolutely, by all stretches of imagination.
How does he know more than Butch?
He just does. He has gone into the theoretics of it. He can break it down on the short game. He breaks down the long game of different positions. He tells you how your body works. He tells you how your arms work. He tells you how the club head works going through the grass.
Yeah.
I've spent a good bit of time with Pete Cowan when I was out on tour. He was in Europe at the time, so it was great. His short game lessons were legendary. His bunker play was legendary. And how he thought on the golf course, how he thought on the range was legendary. He didn't fit everybody because he was very, very technical in the golf swing part of it and very technical in pretty much all parts of it.
Right.
But he would explain what was going on in detail, while some of the other coaches weren't able to, you know, vocalise what was actually going on in your golf swing. You know, they'd tell you to do a few little things, but Pete Cowan would tell you why to do them and what was happening when you did them.
And, you know, was he a good player in his day, a very good player?
He was an average player. Okay. He played the European Tour at its beginning when there wasn't much to be played, you know what I mean, around. Yeah. He went to it was like the Challenge Tour that he played. But I could never see Pete Cowan retiring. He's a Bob Torrance, you know, he'll be there until the end. Mm. You know, I think he was originally the Black Knight. He wears black all the time. Yeah, His whole suitcase is black. Wears nothing else.
Do we know why?
I don't know. To be totally honest with you.
I guess it's not something you ask someone on the range. Pete, why are you wearing black?
Today? Yeah, again.
But I think
did you change
can.
That shirt?
Yeah. I must say I find him a very interesting figure. And look, there's no question. I've never met. I don't know Butch Harmon. I know he's retired now. So, but like, there's it's that element that Cowan is about getting the players to take responsibility for their own swing. I wonder if other golf coaches, and I'm not naming any because I don't know, but I wonder if others are more reliant on the no, come see me, I've got the fix for you.
Yeah.
And so you kind of, you know, that relationship. Whereas Cowan seems to be is that, look, I'm going to tell you what I know. Now go away and do it. And it's up to you. It's, you know, and it's almost as though Cowan doesn't need to be your coach. It's like he's like telling you, look, come to me if you want. And this is what I've got to say. And if you like it, great. And if you don't, great. That's fine.
Yeah. So that's, I didn't realize you had him up that high, Peter, that he basically knows more than anyone.
I personally think, yeah. And remember, he's humble beginnings and you know, he's still very humble. Like he doesn't come across flash or anything like that.
He could be garnering a lot more attention right now if he wanted to. He could be doing a lot more media.
Oh, of course he could, yeah. But he shies away from all that.
Now, he does have a giant spread on The Guardian today, but, I mean, TV, he could be doing even more if he wanted to. So, like, Woodland, 35 years old, I kind of thought this guy, you know, the big hitter arrived on the scene and just plateaued into a fairly lucrative but unremarkable PGA Tour career. Are we now looking at him as a future major winner? I mean, I'm sure he'll contend. He's in the world's top 25. I'm definitely not looking at him with new wonder and thinking, God, Woodland's going to win two or three of these.
No, he's not a Brooks, but look, he's up there. He's a very, very good player.
Yeah. The chip on 17, as someone tweeted, was an amazing moment. That was the last bit of hope extinguished, but because he was under pressure all the way around. That was what was impressive about the win. Brooks was always exerting a bit of pressure on him. Koepka starts in thrilling fashion and has his, what, five birdies or four birdies in the first five holes, or five and six, whichever it was. And it was amazing. Like, it was like rocket fuel for the whole tournament.
Yeah.
He did fall away in the back nine. He did hit some errant tee shots. He did hit one or two errant approach shots. Like, I'm of the opinion that it was there for him and he didn't quite get it done. But it wasn't a choke. I just don't know if he quite had it, whatever it was. He still has furthered his credentials as a legend. But
I think he just ran out of gas.
Do you think so?
Yeah, that's what I got from it.
Mm. He shouldn't though, because he was fresh. Like Claude Harmon said, he didn't pick up a club until the Tuesday at the Canadian Open. That was one of the reasons his swing was off on Thursday, because he'd done nothing. Like I was kind of thinking, he needs to do a bit more. He needs to at least like go and hit 40 balls at a range.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, as Fionn was alluding to, McGinley was saying he was taking the club way on the inside. They had to rush the range on Thursday. Six balls in, they found it again, found the slot, and he was back up and running. But I was like, geez, the Tuesday after Bethpage. It's like, how am I playing more golf than Brooks Koepka? I don't know. I just don't think he quite had it on the back nine. Maybe it is running out of gas. I don't know.
Well, the back nine is traditionally the harder to score on. I think it's when he didn't birdie the sixth, he felt. I don't think he failed to do it.
No.
I don't know if that's the right term.
He made Woodland win it, in fairness, I thought.
He made Woodland win. I think that's very well put. What he did is he put himself in an amazing position with four birdies in the first five holes and then didn't birdie the par five sixth. I want to talk about the par fives in a second. But like, and that, I think, kind of just your momentum just slows down a bit. And like, momentum is obviously a very important thing, like, and hard to quantify and hard to kind of assess. But it's like his momentum stopped and he just ended up kind of shooting a pretty average to good round of golf as opposed to exceptional thereafter. And as you said, like he did, he went offline a little bit. He hit a couple of his approaches into the rough and he was kind of making pars rather than putting himself into birdie chance. And as you said, and then to go back, Woodland's chip on 17 was sublime.
Yeah.
But it's not just a testament to Woodland's much improved short game. But, and this is what I wanted to segue to, is that, you know, they went back to the original 1929 redesign of the 17th. And so had, for instance, the 17th green remained the way it was, say, in 2010, where it was virtually unpinnable in US Open conditions. Like that was, I mean, I don't know if you remember that, Peter, but like the complaints about the 17th in 2010, where it's just, you just couldn't hold it. They will put the pin in a tough spot and the balls were just rolling off the green.
Sure.
Well, they went back to its original 29 design. So that kind of hourglass shape was much more pronounced. The neck wasn't as narrow. And paradoxically, it allowed for that chip, because had it been 2010, no way that chip was holding. No way that chip was finishing 2 feet from the hole. It would have been off the green. And so it's kind of a confluence of things. You have this great redesign that's intelligent. You had a much improved short game. You had Brooks Koepka kind of just running out of juice or whatever it was. And it all conspired to give Woodland this major. So I thought this was a really interesting kind of narrative all happening at once.
Yeah. Do you agree, Peter, that Koepka in finishing second has just only furthered his credentials? That this was a great effort?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think everyone's of that opinion. What about the setup generally? Like, Fionn, we'll come on to your par five's point. Phil Mickelson echoed what most players said. I have to hand it to the USGA for a great setup. The best I've ever seen. It's identifying the best players makes the players the story. I think you've got to give them credit when they do a good job. Many times where they haven't. So credit where it's due. That was Mickelson's thoughts. They were the thoughts of all the players. And I started to wonder, is there a point where all of the players saying it's great means actually you've completely buckled here under the pressure? You've lost your nerve. And unless there's a few players saying it's too tough out there, it's not really what the US Open's meant to be. Did they, were they too generous, I guess is the point. I appreciate the wind never got up.
I think definitely it was the weather. It was the weather factor that never happened. I think the golf course was set up exceptionally well. It was set up difficult. Pins were, you know, hidden away as best they could. But I think if they'd got a little bit of wind there, you know, very few people would have finished under par.
Okay, so you well run, good tournament, and you just have to accept the weather.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fionn, what'd you make of the setup?
I agree. I thought it was terrific. I thought it was, you see, any harder than that and good shots would have been penalized.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what pros, I mean, you had low numbers all around because the weather just failed to show up. But yeah, it was set up, like the rough was high and tough. I mean, they did, like, I mean, they obviously, they buckled a little bit. They don't want what happened at Chambers Bay. They don't want what happened even last year. So, like, you know, like gradual green speed rollout. Like, they made sure they used wedding agents and made sure that the greens were receptive and that the ball would hold. You know, they were hoping the wind would go and introduce a bigger challenge, but it didn't. And that's okay, because it meant good shots were rewarded and bad shots were punished, which is exactly what a setup should be. Now, I listened to your interview with Paul McGinley, and I you know, it's hard to, like, Paul's point that he's definitely in the minority and that he prefers, like, a really tough setup so that the winning score is no more than five under. I mean, obviously, that's a fair point. The US Open's meant to be the hardest of all setups, but like, they set it up expecting wind to blow and it didn't. So you can't then go in and trick it to make it like almost impossible because you have benign conditions. So
is there much they can do, Peter, besides pin positions?
Easy pin positions, in fairness.
Is there much they can do besides pin positions 2-3 days out when they realize the wind is scheduled to be close to non-existent? Are pin positions your only real defense at that stage?
And put the flat, pin placements and move the tees back, or, you know, move around the tees, you know, to cause a little bit of confusion.
But you can't do much with the rough. You can't do much with the, can you do much with the green speeds?
You can get them fractions quicker, yes. Yeah. You can double cut them in the evening times and double cut them in the mornings. But they just then had to be careful, because if the sun came out,
bake them,
you're gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there was a layer of, what's it called?
Marine layer.
Well done. I knew you'd know that.
Cloud.
You cultured git. I knew you would.
Marine layer.
No, it's marine layer.
It's cloud.
Well, I liked marine layer. It gave it a whole a mystique, I thought. By the way, here is the top 10 in case, like, because it's funny, I just looked at it today, because you don't when you're just like Woodland, Koepka. So Woodland was first, Koepka second, John Rahm was third. Completely passed me by. I feel like I didn't see John Rahm all week. Ches Reavie. Well done, Ches.
Do you know, I came in here last the podcast before, and I was looking at the odds, and, you know, we have these odds guys that do it on the internet, and they said Ches Reavie, and they gave reasons for it being one of the best iron players on tour and all the rest.
Impressive, because he's not a big hitter. He finished 7-under. Justin Rose, +3 on the Sunday, 7-under, tied for third. Rose was band-aiding his game all week with short game. It was like the polar opposite Justin Rose.
Oh, he played absolute drivel.
Drivel.
All week.
Yeah. And like, we were right not to tip him last week, but he almost made a fool of us all.
Yes.
Xander Schauffele, by the way, tied third. Just to point this out, by the way, Xander Schauffele's last three US Opens, third here, 6th 2018, 5th 2017. The Open Championship last year, tied for second. So keep Xander Schauffele in your mind for Portrush. And at the Masters, just gone, tied for second. Schauffele is banging on the door. And then we have Westhuizen tied for seventh. Wasn't it good to see him back? What a swing. And Adam Scott, who I had a each way bet on and finished outside the top six, tied for seventh. He pissed it away on me, Adam Scott, with his out of bounds. But I'm not bitter. And then, +1 on the Sunday, 5-under overall, tied for ninth. He was in the second last pairing. Rory McIlroy, discuss, Fionn. Double bogey on two, and I thought, you're kidding me. You're just kidding me. He played great.
He was so unlucky on two. He really, really was. I mean, it was...
Fionn, I don't think you understand what I was setting you up to do there. You were meant to hammer him. What's going on here?
Oh, yeah. No, but I am going to hammer him. He was very unlucky on two, okay? But then he just played shite. Like, just nothing after that. Mm. And it was like... It's like, now, in fairness, I have to, the only reason I know this is because I kept looking at my bloody phone to see what his score was, because you didn't see him again. Like, we saw him, he made, like, a good putt later on, but, like, otherwise they just stopped featuring him in the round. So I had to follow, like, his form on the phone. And, ugh, look it, if he had an ounce of Koepka's concentration, you know, or if he'd done what Tiger Woods did. Now, maybe this is going to sound really, really unfair. Tiger Woods, like, played like he had one arm for the front nine. What is he, 37 out, 32 back, and then just kind of, like, grinded out this unbelievable back nine and ended up on 2-under. But, like...
What Woods did there, by the way, was just so impressive. I'd say
it really was.
Of all people, Peter, can appreciate. Imagine what he's achieved in the game. This is, like, this isn't even a footnote where he finishes here. And...
He still tried.
Find the wherewithal to be such a pro to try. Like, if I'm out of my local Saturday comp after six holes, I lose 30%. Yeah, you know, I just, you know.
Well, that's what happened to Rory, wasn't it? He doubled the second and he said,
"That's it.
You know, take me away, you know, ring the jet and get the pilots ready. I'm out of here."
I mean, is that fair enough?
I don't know.
No, genuinely, is that fair? Like, that might be fair enough.
No, look, it's not. No, it's not.
It's not fair to like the likes of Fionn, who likes watching golf. But when you're in Rory's situation, and I'm not defending him in any stretch of the imagination, I just feel that he doubled the second and he thought, oh my God, I've let another one go away.
He had played really well up until the 56th hole. I mean, there was another double bogey in there the previous day, and there was always the fear he could throw one in. But like, he started off well. And he got himself in the tournament for the first time in a while. So that's a good sign heading to Portrush.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the least convincing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's ultimately it comes down to the thing of, like, I mean, you know, maybe that's just who he is. He's like, look, I either win, I don't care about finishing 8th or 18th. It makes no difference to me. Mm. And maybe that's just how he is. Okay, fine. But, like, it doesn't make for good spectacle, and it doesn't make for you rooting for a player. It's hard to root for the guy. If I can't win, it's my ball, I'm gonna go away and I don't want to play. Like, it's just I don't know, it's just, I'm sorry, and maybe I'm being overly harsh on him, but like he's set up to challenge. He's no, you know, him and Brooks and Justin Rose, well, Justin Rose was a few shots ahead of him, but like at the start of play, but like, these are the guys who are going, Gary Woodland, we have you in our sights, we're coming for you. And like, you know, now, if he was on the pod right now, he might turn around and goes, lads, did you not see my chip on the second? Like, I tried to get it close and I went in. I couldn't get it out of the long grass. So, yeah, but like, anyway, very disappointing, I have to say.
After the second hole, Tiger Woods, and we all have to look at the best player in the world, who was the best player in the world. He didn't give up. He kept on going. And I don't know, I was taught as a kid never to give up. No matter what happens, you keep on going until the last hole.
Yeah, I'm going to defend Rory a bit. I don't know. I think give up is strong, honestly. I'd say he kept at it. And we didn't see enough of his shots. Like, if you just, you know, the scorecard doesn't tell the full story. There's
no.
Do you give up or are you having a tough day? And
yeah.
I think I'm chalking this up as a much improved major because he was at least in it. And that would give you a bit of hope going to Portrush, to be honest. And it's all in the midst of a brilliant season, you know, like we're just being so demanding on the guy at times as well.
With greatness comes responsibility.
Well, I know. Woods, by the way, this is what worries me more than anything. So Woods is gone to Thailand for a holiday now, family holiday. He's not going to play competitively now until Portrush. Now, I just don't like this. I don't like the way this is all shaping up post-Masters. I'll go into Bethpage, stink the joint out, won't play again. I'll go into Pebble, do moderately okay, won't play again. Like, does anyone feel the next sentence is, I'll go into Portrush and I'll win?
Not a chance, no.
No.
He's the 48-year-old Jack Nicklaus. When did Nicklaus win his last major?
46.
And after that, you know, retire gracefully.
Do you know, I heard someone say this, and I totally agreed. You know, before he won the Masters recently, all I cared about in most terms was where's Woods, what's he doing, how are things going? And now that he's won the green jacket, there's an element where, like, genuinely everything is kind of bonus material. I'm all right not to see him, all of his shots. I'm kind of, he doesn't have to be the story anymore. Like, it can't get any better than Augusta anyway. And I'm almost just happy for him to be part of the furniture. But he doesn't have to be the main attraction in every tournament. Where he was before, that could be just me. I'd say other people are itching for him to get to 16 and tear their hair out. Yeah, no, look, I know.
Yeah, I think the worrying thing for him is that he, you know, he was wearing that KT tape on his neck or in his back, and you know, as they were saying, is that by his own admission, everything ached. It was cold. It wasn't that warm. It's not going to be that warm in Portrush. So maybe Woods is very realistically going, I don't play that well unless it's like nice and hot, unless it's got that humid back loosening conditions of Augusta.
Yeah,
I'm not going to do that well. So
very, very interested to see what he does schedule-wise post Portrush. Do we not see him until 3 weeks before Augusta now? Who? Possible.
Well, look, after a Portrush, what is there?
I mean, there's FedEx and there's President's Cup, which he's obviously going to. He can't captain and play in, but like you're qualified to play in now. So it'll be the best indicator we'll have of where his body's at.
He can captain and play, can't he?
Yeah, well, I mean,
theoretically, yeah.
I guess he'll probably do it. But imagine he said, I'm just going to captain and not play. I just think wherever his body's at, he's not going to tell us fully. We're going to know now by his schedule post-Portrush.
Yeah.
Can I just introduce my other disappointment of the week was the par fives.
Go on.
So 28 of the 33 eagles for the week were given up in the par fives, which is as you'd expect. Three of the five easiest holes were par fives. The sixth, and I'm looking at the numbers here, played at 4.585. Well, the 18th was 4.887. The first time in six US Opens that the home hole averaged under par. The fives were far too easy.
I thought a lot of them were making a mess of the fives, though, it felt like.
There were so many irons hit into the 18th. Like, six eagles for the week.
But they're
US Opens.
Isn't there a problem with 18, though, that, like, the tree used to be in play, and now, obviously, technology is technology. There's just nowhere for that 18th tee box to go.
No, when you're hitting 3 wood past the tree now.
Yeah. Like, it's on a cliff. If it was Augusta, they'd buy the three houses behind them and it'd be a different story. They just can't. That one is just, you
know. They've got to make it a par four.
Par four, maybe.
But they can't have a par 69. That's the problem.
Why is that? Is there just no such, you're just not allowed?
It's just not US Open. US Open has always been par 70.
71.
That's right. Now, having said that, what about the old, now this is absolutely just a kind of a rhetorical argument to be made. But the argument that the US Open should be held at Pebble Beach every year. Because it's unbelievable.
Weren't the drone shots Fox put together unbelievable?
I have to say, Fox, you mentioned earlier that Fox have really revolutionized broadcasting with audio. Their drone shots were fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, just to get a sense of place and wonderment was brilliant.
Apparently Jim Nance called into the Fox box to do kind of a quick segment, and he said as well that he's living there, obviously, and got married on the seventh green. And he was saying, I'm seeing angles here I'd never seen before. Like from out at sea, looking back at it.
Yeah.
Which is just brilliant.
The only problem having Pebble Beach as the US Open is the time difference.
Oh.
Because the time difference in this US Open, that was my big...
Did you watch it live?
I tried to watch it. I fell asleep half of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And woke back up and then fell asleep again.
I was a Monday morning. What were you, Fionn?
Because I was jet lagged from being in California, it was perfect for me. So I was up in bed while my poor wife is like fast asleep behind me, and I've got headphones on watching it on television. And I'm like, every so often she's like waking up, what? And I'm like, oh, no, nothing. It's just me yelling at the TV.
Just me yelling at Rory again.
Come here. One other thing.
This has to be very, very quick.
Yes.
Yeah.
Victor Hovland. Howlander.
That's so weird you said that. I was just about to say two last things next week, and then I have a special announcement to bring people. But next week, the Travelers Championship, and I was going to say, skip down to the 50-1 contender. Forget about Brooks Koepka favourite and Cantley and Justin Thomas and Paul Casey and Spieth. 50-1, Victor Hovland at the Travelers in Connecticut. He just looked like a very likeable young man.
Breaks the amateur scoring record set by Jack Nicklaus in 1961 or whatever, 60, whatever it was.
Before we get to, like, I'm all in for this, right? I'm all in for it. I love Victor Hovland. He was very likable, and what a swing, beautiful looking thing. At the same age, Jordan Spieth was like winning majors. So let's not, this ain't the second coming.
Oh, no.
He's good and everything, but he's 21.
But he also, like, he was U.S. amateur champion last year, finished best amateur this year, and, finished well up in the placings. As you said, beautiful swing under fairly kind of tough conditions.
Pressure. He's playing with Koepka.
Huge pressure. He's playing with Koepka. And he held his own, nice smile. Like, he turned pro straight away.
Yeah.
Like, do we see him as the second coming of anything? Well, time will tell. Mm. But, my God, he was impressive.
No.
He looked like a right-handed Mickelson.
Interesting.
Coming from college.
Yeah.
Similar kind of attitude, all smiles and very confident in himself. And I think we'll see a lot from this kid. And if I can put my heart on the table here, I much prefer to see a guy at 21 years of age going pro rather than your 17, 18, 19 year old.
Fair enough.
They can understand life a whole lot better at 21 than they can that little bit younger.
One point, by the way, on the setup, I definitely heard this somewhere else as well. I just can't remember. I've listened to too many golf podcasts since Sunday. It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. You know the way we're looking at the course setup, saying, oh, it's a bit easy. Maybe show the people further back making a balls of things to highlight all the jeopardy. Because you just see the best players, the best groups. I thought that was a good point. Anyway, I really have to move on because we're going to be kicked out in a second. So Travelers Championship is on. Koepka's there, said he's mentally exhausted after the US Open, frankly, having to play epoxy PGA Tour events, raining his parade as well. And then Westhuizen's there, Fleetwood, Reed, they're all there. The BMW International Open in Germany, Martin Keimer favourite, Matt Wallace there. Jordan Spieth in the field in Germany. Wow. Do these lads all get BMWs for playing this thing?
Ching ching for Jordan.
Will they get BMWs as well?
They get the use of BMWs. In the BMW that week, they have a line of cars out the back, right? And you just go to the front desk.
What
and you
make
go,
are they?
Mercedes.
Sorry, it's childish.
And you can take whatever one you want. You can take it for the evening, you can take it for 2 days, whatever.
Listen.
Myself and Damien used to fly around in our i8.
And how was that?
Fantastic.
It's grand life. But do you reckon, don't they give Porsches for the Porsche one?
For the winners?
No, I just thought for to get the big names over.
No. Cash is king. Come on, Joe. Yeah, cash is king.
Joe, for God's sake.
Who wants a car?
How much is, a Mercedes as well, or a BMW as well? 50 grand?
No, it's true. Sorry, I'm really not thinking that through.
Can I just
nothing
say,
to these guys.
Save your BMW, I'll have a million.
Can I just say something? Here's a tip. And just watch him coming up, because I feel it.
Right.
Peter Uihlein.
Oh, good.
Joe's good friend.
We played the Pro-Am together in Curtin.
Okay, Peter Uihlein.
Why do you say
over
this?
Over the next few weeks.
Good. Yeah. You've been hearing good things.
Yeah, over the next few weeks.
Peter Uihlein, everyone, is he playing in Germany? I'm going to check that now.
He'd be in America, would he not? He got
us in he's over there, yeah. Okay, good, good. I've been waiting for Peter since 2013 to kick on for me. Now, as you may know, before we go, there is the inaugural Off the Ball Open, which is taking place in November in Abu Dhabi. We'll be celebrating that. And if you want to get involved and come along in November, where Peter Lawrie is doing a clinic as well as a gala dinner. You're not in the gala dinner, but there is a gala dinner, and we're playing the Yaz Lynx and the National. Chemical Ban is going, Kieran Donaghy's going, and we're playing those two courses. There's 5 nights in a 4-star hotel, the Peter Lawrie Golf Clinic, gala dinner, and a roadshow as well. November 17th to 23rd in Abu Dhabi, offtheball.com/open is where you can get all the details on that. To kind of kick that off and to have an Irish Open, a little celebration, we've got some free golf for you, Golf Weekly listeners. I've waited till the end to do this so the loyal listeners hear about this. See what I've done
well
there?
Well done, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's
I
important.
Like the way you're reading it just as you read it out too.
Someone sent me the email. I know all the details. I should ad-lib really for a sense of flow. But the Abu Dhabi part is offtheball.com/open. To help launch that, we are playing Paris Court, and it's going to be on Monday, July the 1st. Paris Court, Monday, July the 1st. Totally free, Golf Weekly listeners. 2 o'clock shotgun start. I'll be there, Nathan will be there. You're on holidays, Peter.
I'm on holidays.
I'm not going to drag you over from Manchester for this. There'll be 18 holes of golf, there'll be some food afterwards, and we're going to record a little golf pod type chat. We might get Dermot Cleese or someone out to talk all things Irish Open, which is on that week. So, July 1st, Paris Court in County Wicklow, 2 o'clock start. If you want to come along, it's very simple. Text the word golf, 53106, with your name. I know usually we do tweets and get you to tweet out. We're not doing that this time. It's text the word golf, 53106. And we'll leave that open until next Tuesday, and then we'll be in touch with the chosen few.
Should they put their handicap as well with their name?
No, there's no need.
Okay.
Just your name and your texts. Yeah, no need.
I may be at that.
Oh, well, if you want to come, do. And obviously, for more info on the Abu Dhabi adventure on the...
I'll be there.
17th of November to 23rd. Offtheball.com/open again is where you get all the details there. So golf 53106. Obviously don't text if you can't make it on Monday, July 1st. Shotgun start 2 o'clock. So we'll see some of you guys there. That'll be good. Fionn, thank you.
Thanks.
Peter, thanks for making it.
Cheers, Joe. Thanks.
Say hello to everyone at Spanwell for us.
Will do.
Be out soon. I'll be out on Monday morning.
Good man.
Yeah, okay. Nice right, that's us done. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little J.D. starter kid right here. Golf Weekly from Off the Ball. Brought to you by the Off the Ball Open in Abu Dhabi this November. Book your place now at offtheball.com/open.